Mini episode 1921 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
I think we're going to see a lot of upsets next year. And I think, you know, for this whole thing about it's, you know, it's an 8-8 league, Pete Rozelle's dream of an 8-8 league. I'm not saying that that's where we're going necessarily, but I think the odds of anybody necessarily being, you know, 3-14 or 14-3, I think it's going to be more in the middle than it generally is. And I think that this is a reason why, because even some of the lesser lights in the league, they don't have nearly as many holes as you would think. And in some cases, they have less holes than the superior teams. So, Chris, I want to get your thoughts on that. I'm sure you must have some thoughts on this whole syndrome.
Geez, I haven't really thought about it in those terms. You kind of stumped me.
Didn't mean to put you on the spot. Okay, I just wanted.
No,
you
always I hadn't really gone there. Maybe Jason has some initial thoughts and I can piggyback that.
This is one of those things that feels like the tide raising all ships type situation, where if there's going to be a philosophical shift, and we've already seen some of it play out in the numbers you just spit out, is it a bad thing, right, if there's one or two teams with 13 wins or more, and there are one or two teams that have 2-4 wins, and the bulk of the rest of it falls within 7-11 wins, right? The quality of the product is actually getting better if that's the case. So yes. I definitely see that there's evidence to suggest that that could happen. When it happens, I won't be surprised, but I think the silver lining there is that's just good for the league. If that happens,
it is less slop always, football.
Mm-hmm. Hasn't it always basically been a bell curve? I mean,
yeah,
really?
It's just the smaller points can be bigger.
I guess I see the hypothesis, Rick. I don't know that I'm ready to say that there's anything new going to be occurring.
Okay.
I need to see a little bit of evidence to that point. I don't know if that's kind of what Jason was saying, but
okay.
Nothing surprises me, but I think historically it's a bell curve, and you know, and we always have that one team that's, you know, 13-4 and everybody else is 9-10 wins and
yeah,
you know, scraping into the playoffs. It seems like that's every year.
We'll see how it plays out this year, because this is not something I'm used to seeing. Generally speaking, there's a correlation, a strong one, between the higher-ranked teams in the league have less needs, the lower-ranked teams have more needs. Again, the Rams are always sort of an outlier with that. And I want to talk about this here again as somebody who in the pre-draft guide, and you can find it again right there on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com along with this post-draft rankings. Of course, 2026 Pro Football Draftology, our draft guide that is powered by Jason Jones's power rankings and a whole bunch of other great features in there, as well as, you know, Jason's rankings by position and top 100 overall. In my early predictions for next year, I had picked, and some might call this a gimmick pick, in the City of Angels on Valentine's Day, Rams over Chargers in the Super Bowl. That was my early pick. And right now I have flip-flopped. I got Seattle back on top of the heap. It's not just a matter of the Rams going for Ty Simpson at 13. And that was a thing where, and Jason, I had made the point during the show that in a month when people were complaining about WrestleMania that the worst fantasy booking you were finding was actually in football. All these nerds trying to make Ty Simpson to the Rams a thing. Well, the Rams worked themselves into a shoot, in the words of Hulk Hogan, because it ended up being Ty Simpson. And so he's going to be, quite frankly, potentially their Jonathan Kuminga or James Wiseman. We've seen a team try to go for two timelines before. How did it work out for the old 73-9 Warriors? How'd that work out, huh? Didn't work out so well. So for the Rams, you know, you got to go for the daylight when it's there. And the opportunity cost of passing on, say, Lemon at wide receiver or some of these other guys, they, I think, may come back to rue that, as opposed to Seattle at 32, getting their replacement for the running back who was plucked from them. Also, getting him in the first round, that means you got him for 5 years. So it's going to be another 5 years until somebody like the Chiefs can gravy train your running back and overpay him to steal him away from you. An excellent, excellent running back. I know Chris disagreed with me a little bit during the draft on the value of it. I thought what Seattle did in that spot was brilliant because they filled a big, big hole that they had there in that spot. And I think it was enough to push him back past the Rams. So I'll start with you on this, Jason. Your thoughts about the top of the league and the way that it shakes out now. I think Philly, by making the aggressive trade to get an edge rusher, put themselves right back in the conversation as well. And we're looking at, again, as has been the case the last couple of years, probably the NFC predominating this discussion.
Yeah, no, it probably will. It's funny, as you were explaining that, I was thinking to myself, so Kansas City is to running backs what the John Elway era Broncos are to quarterbacks.
Yeah, pretty much.
We're just not going to pick someone and develop them. We're just going to go poach.
Yep.
Somewhere
pretty
else.
Pretty much. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the only thing I want to say about Kansas City, and it is very much a fan take, is after they get Mahomes and then Kelce is Kelce, and then they go on this run, right, which is in the past. The only thing we can really hope for is a slow death, that they keep thinking that they're one player away when they're not.
Right.
Them aside, and you have them dead in the middle of the pack. Mm-hmm. Them aside, the beauty of
largely because Mahomes won't be in at the beginning of the season. They'd have been probably up, you know, 8, 9, 10 at least if he was in then. But so it's a partial year is why, Jason.
But this is why we promote this in our individual lives, I think, to other people, is because the numbers work. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about what we're looking at right now that feels out of place. For example, while I didn't love him coming out of college, and my take on it was about him as a prospect and where he should go, does anyone not believe the Bears are much better than they used to be? Right. And that they're absolutely going to be in the playoff picture? Of course, right?
And Buffalo, that move at safety was just – that was amazing for them. They got another glue guy in there as well.
And then as you go down, as we start to get to the middle of the pack, you're still looking at Baltimore, Denver, Houston, Green Bay, San Francisco. These are all playoff worthy teams.
Yes.
Right. There's no chink in the armor is what I'm trying to suggest. And this is, call it promotion if you want, but it becomes a thing where everyone says, oh, everybody today has a draft guide. Well, yeah, but they're not all graded the same because you, along with some other dignitaries, you can name them if you want to, develop this. It's math. It just works. So the final ranking, I have absolutely no issues with whatsoever. But there are two things that I wanted to mention. One goes back to Jacksonville, and one, we've been doing this show for like an hour, and I'm dying for this to come out, and I'm starting to wonder if maybe you didn't see it.
Okay.
The thing with Jacksonville, as recently as last night, right? So the same day that the draft ended, granted it's social media, but I saw 4 different posts that someone had to take the time to make to shoot and edit and feel good about posting, where they are already asking for the GM's head in Jacksonville. Wow. Okay. And part of it, and permit me to be the Colorado reporter for a minute. I will maintain this probably till the day I die, no matter what happens. If you play Travis Hunter at one side and not both, you are not getting the Travis Hunter you think you're getting.
Agreed.
We all agree that they lost the trade, right? Last year?
I've never
heard somebody in the last couple months that says, no, I think Jacksonville still won. No, they lost that trade completely. And then you look at what they did this year. Unlike the Dolphins, which we talked about, who have players on their draft board that I really did like, I still like, and I think they're going to be great pieces, and the Dolphins fans are going to love that they have those players. I can't find that with Jacksonville. I can't find that with Atlanta. Right. So there are some of these where it just feels like somebody wet the bed. Now, the other thing I have to get out, because it's part a new developing pet peeve I have, and I'm sure many people are going to say that's not nice. I would love to see we continue to move the draft to different locations and we continue to have guest pickers, but can we adopt some rules? We need to stop with the shout outs to people no one watching have ever heard of.
Yeah.
I love the international fans, but like, yeah, you're in America and you're acting real American right now. Yeah. But all of that to say, and I don't remember where it was. If you need, I'll go find the clip because I recorded the whole draft. But I'll go find the clip and cut it and send it to you just so I can get a reaction from you. But there was an international fan or just a guest picker in the middle rounds that got up there and they just started getting real loud. And there was a very familiar inflection. And they were talking about how great the Cowboys or the Giants or whoever it was. And then there's a pause, and the guy looks out across the crowd and says, Pat McAfee's not the only one that can cut a promo up here. Please tell me you saw that.
I didn't. And
oh,
I feel
I'm
like
I'm going to find it for you then.
I
laughed for 5 solid minutes.
It would be only fitting if, for as intertwined as this show has become with my life, if I were to die on air of cringe over something that somebody recounted to me. And I feel like that's about to happen. Call the paramedics because I'm about to die of cringe hearing that, Jason. And Chris, I know that you and I, you know, exchanged some thoughts about this as well here. And just like, I'm so sick of it. I mean, people get tired, I'm sure of hearing me rip about Roger Goodell's NFL and just the entire, you know, dumpster fire of aesthetics that this thing has become, anything for a buck and empowering bozos everywhere. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure Chris, you're going to say it's get off my lawn guy, but you know, guilty as charged, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Here's the thing. I'm glad they've limited it more now to that third day.
Yeah.
Because on days 1 and 2, it really pissed me off. I would also say this. I think they think that stuff is more for the fans in attendance, right? Because it's not good TV product. No. And when you go to the draft in person, you immediately realize, oh, this thing is – I would tell folks when it's coming to your city, like, you're going to be all excited, and don't be. Because it is a much better event to watch on TV, and it is designed for TV. Mm-hmm. It generally stinks to be there in person, right?
Hey, real quick, Chris,
depending on your city.
I've asked 3 years now in a row. I've gone to my bosses and said, what do we have to do to get me credentialed to go cover the draft? And you know what they say every single time? It's not what you think it is. And I know it's a bucket list thing for you in the media space. And someday we will get you out there. But you're probably going to call me within 5 minutes and say, this just isn't what I thought it was going to be. And that's probably what you're alluding to, too, is just like that might just be for the local crowd.
It's like a dark match after Monday Night Raw.
I mean, Cleveland got shortchanged badly with our draft because it was the COVID draft, right? I mean, it was the, it was still quote unquote COVID. So all these protocols in 21. It also happened to be, you know, kind of a cold weekend in April, right? Congrats to Pittsburgh. They got lucky that they had warm, right?
Yeah.
Where our cities in the north, that's a crapshoot, right? You could get 3 days of 40s and 50s in rain, or you could get 3 days of 70s in sun. You don't know what you're going to get up in this part, in this hemisphere, at this latitude. And so congrats to Pittsburgh. They got the good weather. Cleveland got COVID restrictions and chilly weather. But all that aside, even being there, you quickly realize this is made for TV, and it's just not that great being there. I mean, you know, if it was, I can tell you right now, I mean, why wouldn't I have wanted to go to Pittsburgh? It's a 2-hour drive, right? I mean, if it was so great to be at, it would have been like, let's go, guys, let's go. You didn't even hear that out of me. Right.
Yeah.
Because it's not, it stinks. So I have always looked at those shout outs and the, you know, from the stage and all the shenanigans and the former players and the people that can't pronounce names and all the rest of that. I look at that as sort of a tip of the cap to the locals, the people there in attendance. It's a little more raw. It's not polished like days one and two are now that are designed for TV. So I guess it doesn't bother me as much. And I just turn the volume down, you know, on day three and I'm more interested in sort of flipping through, you know, Twitter and, you know, my draft guides, you know, rather than listening to, you know, what's going on stage. But back to the original point, I agree with you, Rick. I think Seattle did what they had to do. I'm still putting the Rams above them because I think that overall in the offseason, the Ty Simpson choice, I get it. It's a future choice. They're rolling the dice. They're doing the Aaron Rodgers play for 3 years from now, and maybe it pays off brilliantly. That said, they've still done things in the offseason to improve that team. Mm-hmm. And they were basically, if you look at the, you know, they're them against Seattle last year, weren't they like within like a point of each other, or maybe exactly the same amount of points against each other, something to that effect. They were evenly matched. Seattle's going to have a harder record this year in terms of schedule than they had last year. There's also there's the Super Bowl hangover. I think the Rams have done enough subsequently between the draft and the offseason that I'm still going to edge them out over the Seahawks, despite the wasted opportunity to get a difference maker, you know, in that 13th spot that they could have gotten.
Yeah.
You know, they just chose not to. I honestly thought that was a spot that, you know, again, we talked about it on live on air. I thought a guy like Sadiq, I thought a guy even like KC Concepcion, you know, those felt like guys that they would go for. And they decided to pass on the opportunity to do so. I still think overall they are going to be finished first in the NFC West.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, and we said in real time, Jason, on the show, that had they gone for Sadiq, for a team that runs as much 13 as they do, imagine having a guy who's an actual weapon and not just a body out there, essentially to be an extra blocker. So there would have been that part to it as well. I have said, but hearkening back to the whole fan participation thing here, I mean, I've said too much on this show. I'd have to get plastic surgery to pull this off, and it's not worth doing. But if I could get one of those Browns designations, like what I would do going up there of just the amount of havoc that I would cause, I would either deliberately read off the wrong player, go into business for myself on that one, or start reading an expose of all of Roger Goodell's crimes and basically force them to run out and tase me in the neck. And that would be something that would be truly astonishing, I think, to behold.
Now, here's what not everyone that's maybe not everyone that's watching this can understand, and we can see you, right?
Yes.
But those of us that know you, even if you had a grand plan for that, and it was all systems go. All I can do is visualize what you would look like doing it. Because you know, like, it's either Frank Sinatra level dressing up.
Yes.
Or it's Hawaiian patterns galore. There's going to be a crazy hat or something. And it would be beautiful, and I would love to see that.
Mm-hmm. Wearing a luchador mask.
There you go. Come out and make brown and orange luchador mask.
Yes, yes. AEW is now making NFL masks. So
would El Presidente make an appearance?
El Presidente very well could. The fictional luchador El Presidente. He's gone to Cleveland Comic Con 3 years in a row. So why not hey, this, real this quick, thing?
Since we're talking about this, and I don't want to belabor the point. Chris is a little bit more forgiving, it seems. And Rick, you're kind of on the farther extreme. And what I'm trying not to do is to develop the same take I have on Super Bowl halftime shows for draft picks.
Okay.
And for anyone that's never heard it, I'm surprised. But when people say, are you excited for the Super Bowl halftime show? It doesn't matter who it is. And I'm old enough that I saw Prince and Michael Jackson and Madonna, and I saw some big names. I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's whoever, I'm forgetting the guy's name that did it last year. I don't care if it's Kendrick Lamar. I don't care if it's Pink. I don't care who it is. If you're asking me what I want for a halftime show, throw it back to the studio like we do for every other game.
Yes.
And I'm afraid that if it gets too shenanigan-y,
yeah,
at the draft, I'm going to probably get to that point where I'm going to say, can we just have the commissioner or the associate commissioner come up and read the name like it's every other pick? So that's why I'm saying if we can just kind of reel back a little bit, maybe I don't have to go that far.
Quite frankly, I've always been bitter about the fact that Rush got passed over and we never got to see YYZ basically take over the entire halftime slot here. Although I don't think with the new gal playing drums, I think the era of the Neil Peart drum solos is come and gone. I will be catching the tour later this year in Atlanta, so I'll let you know after I've seen it. But so that'll
entire
be
an entire halftime show that's just Freebird.
could be that either Freebird or a Neil Peart drum solo, which we'll never get to see in that spot. Sadly.
Either way,
what did you guys think? I really liked the 8 minute and the speed.
Yeah, I did too.
I know that there were some grumblings from the media about how they couldn't get all their points in and their talking points and they're focusing on it. Yeah, right. I can see why. No, I honestly can see from a media standpoint why they really hated it, because they've got their scripts and the things they want to talk about on each player and their analysis, and they can't get through it. They're rushing. The next pick is in. But I'm sure there are fans that love hearing all that stuff. For guys like us, we don't care, right?
Yeah.
About what, Daniel Jeremiah has to say about the 11th pick. I liked the speed. I liked the fact that it was just like, go, go, go. I mean, they were tearing through it, and I liked it. For me, it was a winner.
You hit the nail on the head though. Previously, before you even said that comment, is the draft is made for TV. And if we look at it through that lens, through the focus of what is it like for the guy or girl watching the draft at home on their couch, the 8 minute thing is phenomenal, because I've never thought from a fan's perspective, the first round should never take 3 or 4 hours. There's absolutely no reason for that. Andrew Berry even said in his post-draft press conference that he actually wishes it went faster. But yeah, if you're asking what it's like on the media side, oh, it's a nightmare. I didn't make a single appearance on the draft show with you and Rick or anybody else that participated, because by the time I was done updating what I was working on and you look up, the pick was already in. It's just like, so yeah, from a fan perspective, I think it's incredible. Yeah. I hope they don't change it. I think even going to 6 or 7 minutes in the later rounds, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. but yeah, you were for at least a year or two, you're probably going to hear media people complaining
days.
About.
Well, remember the old days when it was Saturday and Sunday?
Yep.
And yeah, we'd start at noon on Saturday, and the first round was 15 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah.
I wanted to slit my farging wrists. I remember sitting there on my buddy Matt's couch, you know, in Erie, PA, because we would alternate each year at each other's houses. Mm-hmm. And Saturday was the most slow, monotonous, painful. Getting through that first round was like, what? I mean, it took the whole day. It sucked.
Imagine filling time, though. Imagine doing a show. Homeboy and I did 14 hours in 2006 at the Sports Talk Network.
And I guess in some ways, there's always stuff, you know, guys like us can just talk, right?
Yeah.
But, man, again, back to made for TV, you know, when it was just on ESPN and it started at noon on Saturday, and it was 15 minutes a pick. It was not made for TV. It was terrible TV. So I like it now, right? I mean, I still kind of wish it was more of a Friday night, Saturday, Sunday thing versus Thursday night, but I understand why they do that from a rating standpoint. But boy, I like them much faster. From a viewer standpoint, it was like, all right, who's the next pick? Like, there it is. Oh, right. Yeah. I got a moment to tweet about it. I could think about it. There's a couple comments. Hey, we're on to the next one. Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Like that was enjoyable.
You know, it's funny. There was almost a timing that if you paid attention enough and you've done it long enough, there was a stretch there where, and not the top 10, but 11 through 50-ish, right? Both days. Works the same. There was a point where, like, a pick would come down. You'd listen to whoever it was, ESPN, NFL Network, and they would say what they said, and then they would start to fill. And then you'd go, oh, I have, like, 8 minutes before anything happens. You know, if you're a smoker, you could go outside. If you want to go get something to drink, something to eat. You didn't miss anything. And you could literally kind of pick and choose how much consistent watching you did. But then to this year, it's like, oh, no, you're just there because they're flying. The picks are flying. And then when you get to day three, I swear it felt like there was only 5 minutes between each pick. Who knows if there was or not. But I do agree, and I agree with this in a lot of places. Like, I hate it when media people say, like, you know, a Green Bay Super Bowl is going to suck. And really what they're saying is they don't want to spend a week in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, who cares? Like, there are certain things that we have to go through. It's just part of the job. It's understood. And this is one of them. I'm perfectly content knowing that the 3 days of the draft are just going to be chaos and fast and everything's moving, then to go the other way. And then millions of people that are watching on TV are like, why does it take so long?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, the media people will figure it out. The 8 minutes a pick, though, was great. And I think that I didn't feel like it was getting even fan level boring until we got to like the middle of day three. And again, we talked about that. That was those were picks that teams were just cherry picking, or they were just going for what they liked, and there was a little chaos to it. So it was kind of interesting. But as far as the pace goes, I definitely hope they don't go back, because from watching it on TV, it was fantastic.
Well, and like media agendas can be, you know, very, very, very noxious depending on what they are. Like, one of the best examples that I can think of is the second time that LeBron was in Cleveland, when you would have those like Matt Moore and Chris Mannix in the national basketball media that would be throwing grenades into the Cavs locker room, trying to stir up crap all the time. Cause it was like, they would never admit this, but the mindset was, we used to get to go to South Beach in June, and now we have to go to Cleveland in June. I'll do anything to avoid going back to Cleveland in June. Let me start this rumor. Yeah, that kind of stuff there. Like, hey, I'm sorry you don't get to go to your beloved, you know, resort setting.
Hey listen. What? Cleveland in June is lovely. It's going to Cleveland in January and February that I certainly understand those guys.
Yeah.
They would rather have been in Miami.
Yeah.
during those stretches. Yeah. I get it.
Point well taken, Chris. It's all a matter of timing. And my last word on the whole thing with media the night of the draft is, and again, I think for any of us that were going through doing a broadcast of it for the first time with the 8-minute thing here, we all deserve God's grace. It was uncharted waters, whatever. And I say what I'm about to say with love and a little bit of ball busting, but there were a couple points in time when our great friend, the beloved Joe Stazak, you know, he'd be off on a monologue about something. And then I'd come in and like, okay, here's what happened with the last 4 to 5 picks. You know, so it's like the pacing, we hadn't been through this before, right? Nobody knew that it was like, oh crap. Well, you know, I only really get 30 seconds here or whatever. Like, we'll know this going forward. We'll know going forward to expect this, but none of us knew to expect this at this point in time. So
for about a half a heartbeat there, I thought you were about to tell the broken headphone story again.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that was also 20 years ago. Yeah. I'm going to dig out the audio of that one here. The audio, the 2006 NBA draft, doing it at the Sports Talk Network. And that was the Cavs taking what, Shannon Brown?
Shannon Brown, when they were within range to go get Rajon Rondo.
Yes. And you being at a place where, you know, the paycheck status was you had neither a pot to piss in nor a window to throw it out of. And those were your headphones.
Yep.
And you spiked them on the floor. And I was left to like stammer and fill space while you were trying to regroup. Still one of the great pieces of audio of all time. You talk about spontaneity in the moment, brother. That was a thing. That was like,
it's funny. We keep hearing rumblings that he wants to coach.
Yeah.
I swear to you right now, if I am in an arena covering a college game that he's coaching, yeah, I'm going to find a way to go up to him and say, hey, not for nothing, but 20 some years ago when you got drafted and Cleveland was in a position to get you and they let you fall to the Celtics, I literally broke equipment on the air. I was so mad about that.
Your own equipment.
And Rick and I will go up to him and say, hey, remember that game when Geno Ford outplayed you? when Ohio took you guys down when you were at Kentucky? Hey, that was fun.
By the way, that would be pretty great. But one of the greatest fictional taunts of any athlete ever, the late great Anthony Patrone, when he was trying to book some former Browns players at the Wing Warehouse down in Cuyahoga Falls, one of the ones at one point he was trying to book was Dennis Northcutt, whereupon I had decided if that happened, I was bringing my bestie down there with me, who the guy's a Squealer fan. And I was going to have him come up to Northcutt, shake his hand, and say, you're my favorite Browns player of all time. But that would...
There's not many times where I would have been able to say, oh, if that's who you're trying to get,
yeah,
let me call him for you.
Okay.
I don't even know if you guys know this. Before the Sports Talk Network,
okay,
I was an assistant manager at a retail store in a mall.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to plug them because, you know, screw them. But
defunct anyways.
Yeah, and this was at the, now as I understand it now, this hurt me mall in my soul, the now defunct Randall Park Mall.
Yes.
Or for those that don't know, a very much a hood mall. It was literally like sneaker shop, wig store, rim store, empty store, sneaker shop.
Cash for gold.
Dennis so
now it's an Amazon distribution center.
No, it is.
How yeah, soulless I heard, is I heard that,
it's
Jason?
Not the mall anymore.
No, it's not.
That hurt me because I have some great memories. I met LeBron there during the Hummer fiasco.
Oh wow!
But anyway,
Northcutt was there.
Northcutt just walks in. Just in anybody that's worked in retail where athletes come around, they always try to act like they're like everybody else. Like, we're not going to know that you're who you are.
Yeah.
Different story. AJ Guyton played for, I think it was the Pacers at the time. came into Tower City and tried to convince everybody he was just an agent. Nah, no. Come on now. But anyway, Northcutt comes in and he asks if we have these, you know, Air Force One shoes or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, we just got a shipment. What size you wear? And he's like, oh, 12. Like, how many do you have? And I'm like, without looking, probably about 6. And he's like, can I buy all 6? Yeah. You know, and then he would come in and say, oh, you got these jerseys, whatever. So I actually had a, like we're not boys, like we don't talk now, but yeah. Like if Patron was trying to get him, I'd say, let me call him. And I'd be like, hey, the guy that hooks you up at the mall, I got a guy you should probably say yes to.
I would have felt bad about pulling the prank though if we used that connection.
Yeah,
so,
it's probably
you true. Know, you win some, you lose some, you know. But
like, man, my shoe guy set me up.
Yes. Yeah. I don't want to put that heat on you, Ricky Bobby, but all right. So as far as any other thoughts that we have from the draft and what I can say, recency bias aside, probably our most epic post-draft show, I think, that we've ever done for all that we have covered here tonight, all the great topics, macro and micro, just anything else we didn't get to that was on your mind, Jason.
Yeah, real quick, and this we're paralleling some ideas that we've already talked about. But we talked about reaches or whatever we want to call them and how this is going to change, and NIL has done some things. I think, and I haven't really looked at everybody this deep yet, but it's definitely true for Cleveland. I was kind of giving them grief because they weren't going after who I was thinking was the highest rated prospect at that point in time. And yet when it's over, we look at it and it hit me like a freight train. They didn't do what I thought they were going to do, and that's fine. But what they did do is extremely complimentary. I didn't love Casey Concepcion by himself. I didn't love Denzel Boston by himself.
My man.
But you put them together, and now we're doing something. You got Fano, then you go get, as Chris alluded to, a guy who could in the short term be your swing tackle, and you hope eventually he can play right tackle. They went out and got two tight ends to complement, not supersede, but complement what Fannin does. Royer, for those people that didn't watch a bunch of Cincinnati, Royer, to call him a clone is not fair because Fannin's nasty. But they both play similar ways. He's just the Diet Coke of it. He's the Timu version of it. They both fight for yards after the catch. They both catch with their hands. They both run similar level routes. So what I'm getting at here is if you look at the draft as prospects in a vacuum, the absolute value of what they are right now, you might look at some of these teams and go, I don't know why everyone loves it so much. But it's all going into like how the draft is shifting and how teams are looking at it differently now. And I'm wondering if what Cleveland did here, whether we include last year or not and talk about the two-year plan, they got players that fit. Now, this is why it's weird. Pittsburgh and Baltimore have been doing this forever, right? Rick, you called it. You said on the pre-show, who's the WTF player that the league's going to let Baltimore get? And it was Vega.
Called it 2 years in a row now who it was going to be.
Yeah, and maybe I'm giving you extra credit here, but I want to believe that you probably called Hamilton too.
I might have. Yeah, that feels like one.
But it's this thing where, like, you look at certain teams and say, well, they have a type or they have a way that they go about it, and it always works. I feel like some of the other teams are going to catch up with that and go, yeah, why aren't we getting complimentary players? Why aren't we thinking about players like, do these guys fit us? And if that increases, then the whole reach thing increases. Because now they're just going to start chasing guys that are specific for what they're trying to do instead of looking at it as who's the highest rated player on our board in a vacuum. So yep. This was interesting. A lot of people are describing it as being a bad draft. I don't agree with that. I just think that every draft's a little bit different, and teams are going to start learning how to make that work for them.
They're going to need to figure it out. By the way, we talked about this draft night. KC Concepcion, no team in the NFL honors their history like the Cleveland Browns. 10 years after cutting Bernie Kosar for no good reason, they cut Kevin Johnson for no good reason. And 10 years after drafting Corey Coleman, they drafted the next Corey Coleman. So that's we'll see how that plays out. But Chris, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I took the KC Concepcion pick kind of hard because, again, nice young man, plays hard, got the right attitude. I mean, there are three parts to being a wide receiver, right? I mean, there is, first, you've got to separate and run excellent routes as part of that separation. And on the back end, you've got to yards after catch. You've got to be elusive. You got to be greasy. You got to figure out how to, you know, once, you know, it, how to break free, break tackles, whatever. He excels at both those things. Mm-hmm. The problem has been, what's that middle step? Catching the ball, right? Mm-hmm. That's where he has had, and it doesn't appear to be a mechanics problem. It's concentration. Very high drop rate. That was the only reason why I wasn't, you know, penciling him in for the Browns there, because you can run the best routes in the world, but if you don't catch it, you know, you're just Jerry Jeudy again.
Mm-hmm. And you hit the nail on the head. It's a concentration thing. It's not anything more than that.
So I'm going to be hopeful that, you know, because we know he's a quality kid and he's a good character kid and he plays hard. He plays mean. You watch him on film. Like, he's 5'11", but he is beefy. Like, guys are, you know, tackling him and he's dragging him into the end zone. There's some of those clips out there. I mean, the kid's got spirit. I don't dislike the kid, but man, he's going to have to show us something. All that being said, I love the fact that the Steelers draft, in my opinion, was a bit of a mess, and I love seeing it.
Yet another team with a phantom quarterback solution.
Seeing the Steelers absolutely have problems.
Yeah.
And I feel for the kid and Drew Allar, Northeast Ohio kid, Medina graduate, lifelong Browns fan. His family's had tickets for, you know, generations. And he gets the call and he gets drafted and they got him on TV. And you can see he was struggling to put that hat on. He was not liking it. He was grinning and bearing it. Like, I can't believe my NFL dream is coming true and I'm going to be a squealer. Like, you could see his head, the gears were spinning. I feel bad for him, right? I mean, in the sense that, you know, it's like, imagine if you grow up a North Carolina, you know, fan kid, whatnot, and, you know, And suddenly it's like the only school that offers you is Duke, right? Like, you're just like, ooh, right? You know, and that's basically what he just experienced. But now that he's part of the enemy, suck it, Drew. I will say, I want to touch on one thing. We've talked about a lot of things in this draft, and I'm gonna focus on a Browns thing because it's been a topic since Saturday here in Northeast Ohio. And that is the Dee Podesta angle.
Yep.
And people talking about the last 2 years and saying, well, is this proof that the last 10 years has been a mess because of Dee Podesta? And suddenly, you know, the last draft, he was already relinquishing his grip. And this year he's gone. And so now we have arguably the two best drafts in the last decade. And is that proof that Dee Podesta was the problem? I'm going to say this, and I'm going to give maybe a little credit in a place where the misogynists out there don't want to give. But what if it's not a function the last 2 years of Dee Podesta leaving, but more of a ascendance of Catherine Hickman in terms of her work and working more closely with Andrew Berry and perhaps giving him some better insight and some better thought processes because something has changed in what's happened with the Browns last two drafts versus what's happened in the past. Something has.
Is that the one that used to be the chief of staff?
No, she's she came up through the CFL and all that. She is the assistant GM.
Okay.
I know when she sort of does interviews, like the press conferences and stuff, people like to kind of make fun of her, which is usually what, you know, guy football fans do. But I've actually been kind of impressed with her. And again, I know nothing, right? But I do wonder if for someone who showed up in, you know, late 22 or at some point in 22 has now ascended to a point where maybe she's having an influence on what's going on in terms of what the Browns are doing and how they're going about their process, and therefore resulting in a better reading of the board, better reading of values, better analysis on players. I don't know. But something has gotten better with the Browns in the last 2 years and how they've attacked the draft and the results of that. And everybody wants to just say, oh, it's just because DePodesta's gone. And I'm like, yeah, but he was here the year before. And we have no evidence that DePodesta ever picked any player. But I'm going to throw it out there.
Okay.
What if it's actually Andrew Berry has a person in his ear who is, you know, maybe the football equivalent of the character from Moneyball, you know, to his Brad Pitt. I don't know, but I'm kind of wondering that, because that her ascendancy within the organization has me now wondering as to whether or not these improved drafts that she has her fingerprints on.
Chris, your potential theory there, there's enough knuckle draggers in this fan base that would, if they could win the Super Bowl, and it would be like, still not worth it. Durr. So that would be kind of funny to see them have to confront
that. There's an interesting thing with this, because I don't know what her role was previously, but once she was announced as being part of the front office team, they would roll her out in, you know, like year one of that, to do the day three press conference, like the one in between rounds. And like, you could tell that like there's knowledge there, but like her delivery was not that of someone that you would be like, oh, they've been doing this for years. But then I watched, like most fans, right after the draft, I spend the night after the draft just consuming everything, every press conference, every interview, whatever I can get. So I saw her day three press conference. It's different. Like, as she speaks, it doesn't sound like she's delivering the message that Barry told all of the subordinates. This is what we want you to say. And I'm not suggesting that's what they were doing, but you're listening, you're going, oh no, she's actively part of the decision-making process. Like, as she's talking about these prospects, she's telling you kind of where they had them. And like, where's the range at which we feel comfortable trying to make a move to get that player? What are they going to provide to the team? So, while neither of us are going to know which one it is, whether it's more DePodesta or more Hickman, that's an interesting take worth diving into, because she's shown growth and she's shown that she's actually involved. She's not just some person they march out there.
What
tell you this, Rick, for the knuckle draggers out there, she's going to be the first female GM in the NFL.
Okay.
She is a young lady who's on a trajectory, and her reputation, from what I can gather of, you know, just doing some reading and stuff, is her reputation is growing in circles within the NFL ranks in terms of, I mean, she got the opportunity to interview for the Minnesota Vikings GM slot. And I know there's some people who will be like, oh, it's just a DEI thing. I think there's something to it, right? She came from the CFL, and who scooped her up?
Yeah.
Right? Howie Roseman at the Eagles put her in player personnel, right?
Yeah.
And then Andrew Berry pulls her out of Philadelphia and makes her his assistant GM. So there's something there. She's probably going to be the first female GM. And I have a suspicion, and no one's talking about it yet, But I have a feeling these last two drafts have a lot more of her fingerprints on them than we realize at this point. It's a theory, but it's the only one that really makes sense to me why suddenly Cleveland seems like on the draft, like they're nailing it 2 years in a row. Something has changed. And visibly, to Jason's point, she's the only thing that I can see as an external person that suddenly seems to have ascended that would explain possibly why the last two drafts have been better.
Well, we're very pro-meritocracy on this show. So, yes, I mean, look, if her track record comes to justify that, then, hey, God bless her. If she ends up getting one of them GM jobs, it ought to come down to qualifications. An excellent point by you to bring this thing full circle on a night that has been chock full of excellent points all the way through. I'll end it on something a little bit more trivial, but certainly very light, and that being Drew Aller at Penn State. I go back a couple months, FDH Lounge dignitary Ron Glassman, who is one of the prominent alums, organizers, whatever, the Alumni Association of Medina High School. He was canvassing some of us in our fantasy football league at our draft of like, hey, it looks like we might be doing a draft night party for Drew Aller. Like, you guys got any ideas for things we can whatever? And I just happened to say, you could put up a banner that says, congratulations on being a bust like every other Penn State quarterback. And he got like legitimately mad at me. Like, Ron's not a guy that gets like red faced and yells at you, but that's, yeah, I think wow. I pushed him a little far on that one. Like, he didn't think that was funny. So, I mean, I'm going to be right. Whether or not he goes to Pittsburgh, right, I'm going to be right. The guy's going to be a bust. But, you know, it is what it is. It's going to be great to see it happen in Pittsburgh.
The entire time, whether we're talking draft day, the lead-in, pre-draft process, or even last year and the year before, it's a Will Ferrell and Zoolander situation where I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. The quarterback positions evolved to a point that we can all celebrate Jaden Daniels, Josh Allen, types like that, right?
Yeah.
Where do we get to the point where people don't know that they're looking at a statue that can just throw the ball really far? At no point, I don't watch enough Penn State to say this declaratively, but in what I have watched, I believe he's a two-read quarterback who cannot move and navigate the pocket to save his life. He's, on some level, he's Ben Roethlisberger without the short, the intermediate, the touch, the football IQ, and the ability to navigate the pocket. So if all you care about is that he's over 6'3", and he can throw it the length of the field,
yeah,
then, yeah, he's probably just what you want. But if you want a quarterback that actually can do the task of being quarterback, no. And, by the way, not to crap on Ohio State, but this is also the same franchise that swore up and down that Will Howard was the future of that position, right, and he's never seen the light of day. And then they go get another late-round quarterback who doesn't do anything better than Will Howard does.
Yeah.
And I never thought Will Howard would be a starter. So
my dad asked me a year ago why Will Howard wasn't more prominently drafted. There's a recurring theme with my dad there, but in fairness to my dad, he doesn't do the deep dive on NFL stuff the way that we do. So
Listen, I think we should be glad that Penn State choked against Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Because if they win that game, the Browns are probably drafting Drew. and none of us here wanted that to happen. So I'm actually okay with it.
I didn't even know where all of us stood on Drew, yeah, but I can very confidently say that if the Browns had drafted him anywhere under fifth round, so like under pick 196 or whatever, I would have come in here hot. I'd have been livid. I'd have said that the Browns draft was, you know, dog feces. That was I made a list of 10 names that I did not want drafted at all.
Yeah.
At least to the team I follow. And he was absolutely on that list.
Yeah. I can't blame you for that, nor can anybody who ever watched him at Penn State. So, but on that note, again, like I said at the outset here, for my money, you're not going to find a better draft talking crew than this one here. Jason Jones and Chris Galloway, along with me, Rick Morris. We've been doing this as a unit since 2012, just 5 years shy of how long the program's been around, and the pre and the post shows. But then the last 2 years, getting back to doing the live show in between as well. So always one of the major highlights of the FDH year on the calendar. This is one of the high spots that we get, is being able to do the draft coverage here. Cannot thank you guys enough. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge, mini episode 1921.